stakeholders, invited to this meeting, you're welcome to this meeting. You would remember that Department of Forestry, Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, they tabled the amendment bill in the name of performing animal protection amendment bill in this parliament. So this committee has been interacting with the bill. Today we are going to listen to, we have advertised inviting the stakeholders to comment on the bill. Today we are going to listen to those stakeholders that have responded in writing. Before we do that, I'll take the opportunity to introduce the members of this committee. I'm Machene Rosina Sumenya, the chairperson of this committee. other members of the committee, you have Honorable Yong Blue, who's the member of the committee, Honorable Spain, the alternate member from GA, Honorable Vandale, and you have Honorable Souza, the member of the committee, Honorable Njaisa, the member of the committee, Honorable Feltana, the member of the committee, Honorable Kata, alternate member. You might leave us at students any time because he's an alternate member, but you're welcome, Honorable Member. We have Member Makwane, we have Honorable Member Ramukwasi, Honorable Mandela, Honorable Tongwan. I'm going to ask the department to the leader of the delegation to introduce his team. We have received the apology from the DG, who's not available today. The standing and select committee on NCOP is meeting today. She expected to give a report in that committee. So she has sent the delegation. I'll then ask them, the leader, to introduce the team.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. The delegation from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries comprises from my extreme right, Dr. Musoma Tonzi, who is within Veterinary Public Health. And next to me, on my right, I've got Dr. Songabe, who is the director responsible for VPH. I am Mogisa Ramasodi from the branch called Agricultural Production Health and Food Safety. And on my left, immediate left, I've got Madam Kanchi Nagia, who's the head of legal services within the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. And next to her, we have got Mr. Barry Bukis, who's also from the legal unit of the department. And lastly, we have got Master Manza Lukulin, who's responsible also for the VPH. And we have got with us today, Sis Loma, from our office, and from the Deputy Minister's office, we have got representatives too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our stakeholders, what would happen is that as you call one to present, they will introduce themselves, and if they brought a lot of delegation, before you speak, you present, you introduce your delegation. And we have a legal team from Parliament, they are here. You can just wait. And we have the support staff of the committee. You can just wait. I'll now go to request the University of Johannesburg, represented by the Professor D. Wilkin. Very difficult to pronounce, but I've tried my best to present. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you for the opportunity to present to this committee. Just to introduce myself, I'm a professor at the University of Johannesburg. I'm the director of a research institute called the South African Institute for Advanced Constitutional, Public, Human Rights and International Law, in short, SITAC, which is a leading research center in its areas of focus. I have written numerous publications on issues relating to general fundamental rights, but also I've written around issues around animals and the law in South Africa. And I also would like to draw the attention of committee that this submission is supported by the Faculty of Veterinary Sciences, the only Faculty of Veterinary Sciences in the country, from the University of Pretoria. It is supported by the South African Veterinary Association, and it is supported by the Center for Applied Legal Studies from the University of the Witwatersrand. I have a PowerPoint, so I will also be putting up some of the text that I'm going to talk about. Just a little bit of context of why this law is important. In India recently, the government banned the training and exhibition of five wild animals, bears, monkeys, tigers, panthers, and lions, after this was recommended by an expert committee. It looked at detailed evidence provided by animal welfare groups to the government as to the suffering involved in training animals, particularly for circuses of this kind. Some of this evidence is entirely shocking. A well-known trainer, Van Amburn, is quoted by the report as saying that the subduing of wild beasts is merely the result of merciless thrashing while they are young. Alfred Kors, also a reputed trainer, speaks of the most shocking treatment meted out against animals. He says, "It was my turn to be brutal, terribly brutal, and I was. All the clubs I had left in the cage were broken one by one on the tiger's head. Lashes came down like an avalanche, each cutting deep into the tiger's shining coat." And this is quoted in the case of Nahir versus Union of India. A second example, animals regularly appear in advertising, but of course they do not automatically know how to act on the camera. A few years ago, an advertising agency in South Africa wanted to use a mouse in an advert and to show it running against a wall. But how are you going to get a mouse to do that? Mice do not generally move at a speed that would allow for effective filming. So what was done? The mouse was thrown hard against the wall to stun it. And as it slowly recovered and moved along the wall, the camera was able to film it. This is the context in which we are discussing the Performing Animals Protection Amendment Bill. As we know, the immediate context for the amendment came from a Constitutional Court decision, which required a revision of the bill to place the licensing function in relation to the protection of animals within the executive and not the judiciary. Now, it is important to recognize that placing this power within the executive requires attention to the manner in which it is regulated and issues relating, for example, to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So this is not simply moving from one function to another. It requires an act of translation to think very carefully about the provisions of the new amendment. The Performing Animals Protection Act, importantly, also has the purpose of being to protect the welfare of animals. The original act dates from 1935 and is outdated in respect of scientific developments regarding the welfare of animals. This amendment, we submit, offers the opportunity to comply with the judgment, which, as I will argue, is a wider mandate than is expressed in the current bill, but also to update the Performing Animals Protection Act so it adequately protects animals, animal welfare, which is its purpose. To fail to do so, I shall argue, also may render it subject to constitutional challenge. It is also important to recognize that it is the mandate of this committee and Parliament to approve the law. And whilst there are some time constraints here, no doubt, because this, we know that the Constitutional Court deadline needs to be done and achieved in July, it is possible, I shall submit, to achieve these amendments and a better law within the time frames required by Parliament. So what are the key submissions I wish to make in terms of the current amendment? We believe that it is currently defective. As I say, all the bodies that support this, it tries to adopt too minimal approach to compliance with the Constitutional Court judgment. and failed adequately even to do so in a manner that will withstand constitutional scrutiny. To improve, the bill must do the following. It must clarify the purpose of the Act. It must provide clear guiding factors in the law in which decisions are made by the National Licensing Officer. It must ensure that the decision maker must be an expert in animal welfare and only allow delegation to experts in that area. And opportunities must be granted for democratic participation in the licensing process to enable maximum information to be acquired and transparency. We believe also that this is an opportunity which should not be delayed until a further amendment is considered to do a few other things in relation to the other Act. First, the Act should include reptiles and aquatic animals such as dolphins and orcas within its ambit. It is arbitrary. It makes no sense why they are excluded. It should criminalize cruelty in terms of the Act. It should declare persons convicted of cruelty offense unfit to take charge of an animal. It should make provision for the upkeep costs on those who wish to use animals if there is abuse. It should limit the exclusion from the Act, and it should also enable the Minister to regulate and ban certain practices. That is a summary of what I will now go into in a little bit more detail around some of the provisions of the Act. The first is the purpose of the Performing Animals Protection Amendment Bill. It's stated in the current draft to be around technical matters. The original Act also, the purpose lacks clarity. Now, in regard to the decision-making of the decision-maker and the grounds on which they make a decision, it says it has to be done in terms of the purpose of the Act. But how can you make a decision in terms of a purpose of the Act if the purpose is not clear in terms of the Act? Right? This is not good law. This needs to be changed. I have provided some wording. Of course, we leave it to the discretion of Parliament as to how to do that. But the purpose should at least be to ensure the welfare of the animals is respected and protected in the exhibition and training of performing animals and the use of dogs for safeguarding. The second key matter, and this relates to guidance provided by the Constitutional Court in the decision of Dawood. In that decision, the Court said it is an important principle of the rule of law that rules be stated in a clear and accessible manner. If broad discretionary powers contain no express constraints, those who are affected by the exercise of the broad discretionary powers will not know what is relevant to the exercise of those powers or in what circumstances they are entitled to seek relief from an adverse decision. In short, Parliament's lawmaking needs to provide guidance to decision makers, to administrators, as to how they are to exercise their discretion when they are making decisions. Okay? And the key point that I wish to make here is not enough guidance is provided in Section 3F for making a decision. I've already said the decision must be made to accord with the purpose of the Act, which is not adequately defined, and the other criteria are safety and no harm to the animals, right? Which, whilst important, neither of these concepts is adequately clarified. The scientific understanding today involves a multidimensional approach to animal welfare, which includes physical, emotional, psychological, and social dimensions of animal welfare. It is important for this committee to understand that the science has fundamentally shifted around animal welfare since the original bill was passed. The amendment should take account of this and change in understanding and guide discretion in much more detail to take account of this multidimensional approach to animal welfare. So what factors should be included in decision-making, in deciding on what should occur? Well, we suggest the following, again, a provision that involves the exhibition and training activity not causing harm to the physical, emotional, social, psychological welfare of the animal. The animal should be only allowed to be born in a captivity and treated with respect for its welfare since then. We need to know where the animal comes from. It's not just the welfare as a snapshot at the moment at which it performs. It's also a question of what is its origin. The training methods need to be consistent with animal welfare. Conditions in which an animal is kept need to be consistent with animal welfare. The lifestyle needs to be consistent with animal welfare. And welfare, I mean in all respects, social needs need to be taken. taken account. Psychological needs. Provision needs to be made for the welfare of an animal after the performance activity has ceased. Right? What happens to the animal after they've been performing? Right? It's crucial that there's some provision made for that. Okay? There needs to be provision made for welfare if the license is not granted. If the person has an animal in their charge, what happens to the animal if the license is not granted? They need to undertake to take care of that animal. Okay? The person in charge of an animal needs to be a fit and proper person who has no record of animal cruelty or abuse. And of course also, as the current law provides, there should be a consideration of the safety of humans and other animals. Both humans and other animals are involved. Now Section 3H concerns the information available to the decision maker, the National Licensing Officer, and currently only relates to the animal and the performances itself. As I've said, we need to consider the whole life cycle of the animal, the whole environment in which this takes place, okay? And we need further information about the origin of the animal in captivity or the wild, its retirement, what will happen if the license is not granted, plans to meet the social needs of animals, and information concerning travel and consistency with welfare needs, okay? And I believe that the law should expressly require anyone applying for such a license to make an undertaking that they will, in fact, ensure that the welfare of animals is taken account of in all respects and to place a duty of care upon such individuals. A similar problem relates to the appeal. There's no guidance provided in the current law for the basis on which the appellate body created in terms of the Act makes its decisions. Yes, it's very good that the current Act includes the appellate procedure, but it's important that that discretion, how should and what basis should the appeal body make the decision? The primary factor must be whether the National Licensing Officer has exercised his or her discretion in such a way that places the welfare of animals as primary. That's the purpose of this Act. So from the guidance of discretion, the next point relates to the decision maker. And this is, of course, key, because the way in which this Act works is it provides protection to animals through licenses and through this licensing function. Otherwise, there's no protection. So who makes the decision is very, very important, okay? And that, of course, must relate to the purpose of the Act, okay? And it seems to me that if we're going to be rational, if the law is going to make sense, that person must have expertise in animal welfare. The current provisions provide for an animal scientist or a veterinarian to make these decisions, okay? Which sounds good on its face, but unfortunately it's unclear what is meant by the notion of an animal scientist, okay? The field of animal science is referred to in the Natural Scientific Professions Act, and I just mentioned as a matter of technical detail that the current draft of the bill has the wrong name of that current act in it, so it needs to be corrected, obviously, for the law when it's passed. But what qualifications are necessary to be an animal scientist? This could include people working in agriculture with animals, research into animal diseases, working with the cell biology of animals, and in laboratories. There's no clear expertise in animal welfare required to be an animal scientist. Why, if you work on the cell biology of animals, does this qualify you to make decisions about their overall welfare? Okay? Only persons with qualifications which display an expertise in animal welfare should be eligible to make decisions in terms of this law. The fact that veterinarians are included shows us why this doesn't make sense, because they do have certain specific duties, not in terms of their professional duties, not to be exploited in a manner detrimental to animal welfare. And I believe the South African Veterinary Association will elaborate upon this. But that would mean that the veterinarian cannot sanction unnecessary abuse. And there's no similar ethical duty attaching to those practicing in the fields of animal science. Now, this is made even worse by the delegation provisions in the Act. Section 3D and 3E allow the delegation of functions in terms of this Act to an expert or other person other than a National Licensing Officer. This, I would argue, is again going to be irrational, and it's possibly an unlawful provision as a result. Who is an other person? There's no specification given in terms of the Act. If any person can grant a license, then why does this bill sometimes require expertise in that regard. The expertise is also not specified. What is the nature of the expertise required in terms of the Act? Again, the Act needs to relate to its purpose. Any delegation should only be to those with similar qualifications in relation to the protection of animal welfare. If not, that is not possible, then the powers and functions should not be capable of delegation. A similar point applies in relation to the appeal. The chair of the board must have expertise in law, and it states as follows, including but not limited to intellectual property law and administrative law. But again, I had really questions about, like, why are these areas of expertise necessary to make decisions in terms of this Act? If you can register a patent or copyright in terms of, you know, the various laws in that regard, why is that relevant in terms of animal welfare? Okay? Again, we need particular expertise relating to animal welfare and perhaps animals and the law itself. Fourth issue I want to raise relates to democratic participation. One of the great benefits of having the executive make decisions here is the increase it allows in democratic participation. It allows the National Licensing Officer and the relevant delegees to take in relevant information from the public, and they may not have that information. The process allows a decision simply at the moment, as the law stands, on the basis of documents presented. It is true the National Licensing Officer can convene a hearing of some kind, but it need not do so. Okay? And there should be an opportunity for interested persons to make representations to the National Licensing Officer even prior to a hearing being held. A register of applications should be developed, and successful applications should be kept and be available on the website of the Department of Agriculture. That would help enhance the protection for animals and encourage information sharing in that regard. And I note here that the UK Act, which ultimately was, I suppose, the basis on which this was initially formed, the Performing Animals Protection Act, which drew from the UK previously, includes a requirement for a registry to be kept, which is accessible to the public. Again, one of the important things to recognize is animal welfare law has not been changed in South Africa since the development of the post-apartheid suspension, since the new democracy, effectively. And it's important that we recognize that we do not want to keep a colonialist apartheid view of animals still in our law. It is key that we bring our animal welfare law in line with the democracy that we now have. So, what are the key changes to the original Act that I believe should be done in this amendment round, and that is possible? Well, some of these things are clearly able to be done in the time period, and they do not require too much to go beyond what already exists, but they would help protect the welfare of animals. First, the Act should expressly criminalize cruelty to performing animals or dogs used for safeguarding. Okay, currently it relies on the Animal Protection Act. And the offenses should extend to obstructing inspections or concealing an animal from an inspector. If there's a guilty conviction on any of these offenses, including those in the Animal Protection Act, individuals should be declared unfit to take charge of an animal, and this could be determinative in granting a license or not. It is important also that the entry provisions should be bolstered by the right to confiscate an animal where information provided is false and conditions are not adequate for animal welfare. The upkeep of such an animal expressly should be for the cost of the person who abuses the animal. This is quite important because a lot of the time it is very difficult matters to what happens once it is found that there is abuse. And it is very important that the onus lies on those who are abusing the animal and so the cost too. The right of entry should be conferred of societies for the prevention of cruelty to animals and national licensing officers in addition to the police, who do not always have the resources to address these issues. In terms of penalties, these need to be increased for a range of offences in relation to the seriousness of the offence, and cruelty to animals in terms of this law should be regarded as serious. Now I come to some important matters regarding exclusions from the Act. Many of the current exclusions appear arbitrary. If the purpose is to protect animal welfare, there's no reason to exclude animals in zoos, horse shows, dog shows, sporting shows, and caged bird shows. The range should be determined by the subject matter focused on animals in entertainment, not on these arbitrary exclusions. I also believe that Section 7 should be amended to allow the minister to prohibit a performing or exhibition activity which can reasonably be shown to be detrimental to the welfare of animals, and expressly to exclude classes and types of animals from being used, like I mentioned, as the Indian government has done in relation to certain animals. The minister should be entitled to investigate any practices and conditions and that have an effect on animal welfare in this regard. And in terms of the definition section, the Act currently excludes reptiles and aquatic animals such as dolphins and orcas. Scientific knowledge again has increased since the Act was originally passed to show that reptiles have a welfare and can be subject to cruel treatment. And the same is certainly true of dolphins and orcas. Many of you may have seen some of the developments that are occurring in the world at the moment, recognizing the high level of intelligence of these creatures, and India again has banned dolphin shows and the keeping of them in small environments due to the severe impact this has on their welfare. The Act should also, and the definition should also apply, I argue, to all performing animals, whether people pay or not, and whether or not for public or private purposes. And the useful safeguarding should also include all dogs used in this context, excluding, obviously, private and domestic context. And it is also unclear why only dogs are included in the definition of safeguarding, and all animals used in safeguarding should be included. So horses sometimes are used, for example, a lot in the security industry. Why are horses not included in this as well? So, in conclusion, I would like to say, as I've mentioned, that this is the first amendment of animal welfare legislation since the fall of apartheid. It covers areas of very serious animal abuse. The suggested key amendments are necessary particularly to address the purpose, the decision-making criteria, the decision-maker needs to be made rational, democratic participation, and we need wider inclusions of animals and fewer exclusions. This is an opportunity to render South Africa a world leader in this area, and I hope Parliament will take this opportunity. It is not such a complex area that the amendments cannot be done in the time required to do so. This is not just an issue of compliance, though, as I've argued, compliance does require a wider engagement with a number of the issues I've placed to avoid passing an unconstitutional law. But it is a matter, I think, that is crucial for South Africans to take a stand on, and I hope Parliament will take this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prof. Well thought, well researched presentation. Thank you very much. Members, I'm not going to allow you to ask questions now, but I'll get some two more presentation and from there you can engage with the presentation. I'll now call the second presenter.
Honourable Chair, can I just mention I have to leave at about 11:30, so I would be very happy to take questions, but I would need to do that before that time. I apologise for not being able to be here, but I have to teach this evening in university. Enjoy it.
Okay. Do we have the similar problem with other presenters? Okay. Let's take questions for clarity on the presentation by the professor. Any questions? Honorable Spain?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for a very informative presentation. I think it clarifies also for me a whole lot of issues, questions that we had in the past, some of the similar questions that we had on things. Firstly, I just wanted to find out if you have made a presentation or to the department when public participation process from the department side was happening, and if any of that proposals at the time were included in the bill in the current form, because just some of or most of the things that you say is making a whole lot of sense to me. So I'm just interested in that. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chair. My question is regarding your recommendation that the licensing officer, if I can use that term, should be someone with expert knowledge, if I may say, on animal welfare. Why should that be the case? I imagine that because now you're also suggesting that acts of cruelty to animals should be regarded as, should qualify one, let me put it that way, to be criminalized. They should be criminalized, the acts. Now, does a magistrate have to have expert knowledge on the social elements of a human being before he can qualify? I know that we're moving away from magistrates, but I'm saying now, if a, this licensing officer, you say, has to have expert knowledge on animal welfare, because he has got to decide on this, that, and the other, giving license here and there, or refusing a license, would you say a magistrate in a court is incompetent to adjudicate a case unless he has got expert knowledge on all aspects, social aspects of a human being, rather than for him to confine himself with the specific requirements to meet, to be met by the applicant for a license? In other words, let's draw, you know, where comparisons here. Because I've got a problem if you say he must necessarily. I would understand you when you say other persons should be defined. Perhaps you could say similarly qualified or something like that. I agree with you that that's too open, you know. But I've got an issue with this insistence that one should have that, because animal welfare can be very, very diverse. And so are the needs of human beings, and so are the needs, socio-economic needs of human beings. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, first, you know, I would like to maybe just get a clarity on how do you actually see the definition of any animal, okay? Because any animal can be a huge, big definition. Then I want to go back to one of the sections that you stated. It should not be only for payment. Does this also include what happens with, this, for example, the SAP's dogs? What happens to the rats that are trained to go to Burundi to go and take out landmines? What are we talking about, our zoos, our oceanariums, that type of thing? Do you also see them having to be licensed? Thank you.
Chair, mine is on the basis of the expertise. I just want to find out if we say expertise. We also want to say it should be at the highest level of expertise, because in the field of expertise, there are levels. You may be an expert at this level one, you may be expert at level two. So you say, do you wish to see a level at the last level, so that the first level are not discarded as expertise also, if we can clarify your opinion.
Okay,
Chair,
thank you.
Thank you very much for the various questions. Firstly, I did make a presentation last year at the workshop held by the Department of Agriculture. The law has improved from that first draft that we saw, and I believe that the department was responsive to some of the input that was provided, but not sufficiently so. I don't think it really has included all that should be done. So whilst there has been some improvement, and I'm pleased that public participation is meaningful in that way, I believe that there could have been a better draft put on the table, but I believe that that does not mean there isn't time now to make the relevant amendments to the law. The question of expertise, okay, I think two questions around that, okay. Why do we need expertise in this area? Well, it's important to realize that we're dealing with, I agree with you fully, right, there's vulnerability of human beings as well. I work as well in relation to vulnerable people all the time. I do not only relate to animals, only do that in relation to animals. And I would analogize it to you for issues like children, right? If we go to court around children, judges, if they don't understand issues around children, they draw in expertise, right? They will refer to a family advocate. They will draw in experts like social workers, etc., to do a review in relation to a child. And it seems to me that there's a very good analogy in a way in this case, right? Animals, they can't tell us about their needs a lot of the time. They can't tell us. We have to understand their welfare, right? And they are extremely vulnerable creatures, right? And what we've learned from science is it's also not simple. I can't just say, oh, well, I'm an ordinary person. I can simply judge that animal's happy, it's not happy. We actually need to have a look at a lot of issues around its the conditions in which it lives, the origin, all those kinds of issues, the psychological, social, welfare, all these things of whether they've taken account of by the current conditions in which they live. That's not something any ordinary person can just necessarily know from looking at the animal, looking at the environment. It's something that requires some level of expertise. Now, we will come to the question of whether it has to be the highest level of expertise, but nevertheless, it requires some level of expertise, and if we're going to provide adequate protection for animals, if we're going to provide, and this law is going to really achieve what it's meant to achieve, right, we don't want to waste time. We want to ensure that this law is actually going to do what it's meant to do. Well, then we need to make sure that those making decisions around animals actually understand what's happening in relation to animals and their welfare. And as I said, that's why I place great emphasis on this question of expertise, because I do not believe one can just make, you know, any individual can just make assertions. It will not be sufficiently protective unless we have that input into the process and the decision maker to have that understanding. And as I said, I think it will be, there is a difference as well. And as I said already in the judicial process, we have these provisions for expertise in relation to children, for example. But it is a change, as I said, to move it from the judiciary to the executive, okay? And, of course, we could provide in the law that a decision maker can draw in the necessary expertise in making the decision. That would be an analogous provision, okay? But it would be necessary to do that. And I worry about the process, whether or not, when there's pressure to grant a license, whether or not people are going to have an inquiry, and so it would be better, it seems to me, to have someone already with that expertise making these decisions. The third question around around animals, okay, how do we define any animal? Well, the important thing is that the law covers those animals who are obviously used in this industry, okay, and who also have interests that may be affected, to whom there can be cruelty, right? So I've made suggestions that we at least include reptiles, okay, and that we at least include aquatic animals like high-level mammals, like orcas and dolphins. Okay, whether or not this committee would like to go further than that, I leave to the committee. It seems to me that it should be at least include all those animals who have interests, who have a welfare. Okay, and probably including reptiles and aquatic animals would be at this point, because the definition is already includes mammals, would be sufficient. But it might be that it needs to be even more. I know that recent scientific evidence, for example, has shown, for example, that animals like octopi have a welfare. And it might be important to ensure that that class of creatures is included as well. I think you also asked how wide and what would this cover. I think it is important that this law and this licensing law does cover all areas in which animals are involved in entertainment. And I do think that you mentioned some examples. I think certainly oceanariums and aquariums, etc., in South Africa should be covered, and that it's very important to consider whether or not some of the activities are consistent with animal welfare. I think that zoos should not be excluded as well and should be required, because many, unfortunately, whilst some people here might be aware of some of the better zoos in South Africa, there are some really poor zoos in South Africa in which animals are kept in conditions which are lamentable for their welfare. And I would therefore think that it is important, since they are there ultimately for exhibition, right? The animals are there being kept for exhibition. It would be important that they be covered by this law as well. And the last question relates to, as you've asked, whether or not should the expert be the highest level expert, like a vet who studies for 6 years around animal welfare, etc. I'm not convinced that you necessarily need only vets to do so, and it might be the case that that would be too restrictive in terms of the law to only allow a vet. But not only vets, there are people who are trained in animal welfare who are not vets. right? There are forms of animal science that engage today with animal welfare. There are people who engage in other disciplines who discuss and deal with issues around animal welfare in philosophy and law and other areas that have engaged with these issues in many stages. So I'm not sure I believe that it has to be necessarily only vets, but it does need someone who can demonstrate some training or ability to make decisions and who will understand the multidimensional aspects of animal welfare. So it's not just, as we realized in 1935, it wasn't just looking at a very narrow view of welfare, but a very multidimensional element of welfare, which is the basis of scientific consensus today. I hope I have sufficiently addressed some of those questions, but I'm very willing if anyone wants to come back and engage further.
Thank you very much, Professor. I'm now going to allow the second presentation to proceed. Remember, I'm not going to allow second take. Okay, let me allow the follow-up.
Chair, it is just specifically, I mentioned security animals, the police dogs. How do you see that falling into the act?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. The answer you provided me with provokes, more questions than satisfies me. Given that South Africa is multicultural, isn't there a possibility that if we say that licensed officer must be typically qualified expert, so to speak, that the culture of that particular person could be the driving force besides granting or refusing licenses? Thank you.
Thank you for those questions once again. In terms of security animals, my reading currently of the existing provisions is that currently animals used in the military and the police are excluded. I think that it would I think it would be a good idea if those animals are also subject to some regulation to ensure that those animals are treated well. It may be that one would want to think about that slightly separately and not do it in terms of the existing provision. So one might want to provide some procedure for the police and the military that is separate but also has some regard to the welfare of animals. But as I say, I didn't specifically focus on overturning those exclusions because I realize there may well be reasons why things are more difficult in relation to the military and the police, but it is key that we don't send a message to the military and police that the welfare of their animals doesn't matter. It also must matter as well. Okay, so we need to encourage that as well. In relation to the question about bias in decision making, well, it's a difficult question as you asked, and obviously it refers not just in this context, but it refers in wider in South Africa, and that's why it seems to me very, very important to have a diversity of decision makers, right? To have across the racial, gender diversity of South Africa, cultural diversity of South Africa, so we don't get cultural biases influencing decisions alone. That does not mean that we don't have expertise. I believe social workers across racial, gender, cultural biases are important in making decisions around children, and we should take their views into account, but they still have a basis of training in social work. And it seems to me important that animal welfare is not something that is purely culturally dependent, right? There is a fact or scientific answer to whether an animal or not is suffering in a particular environment or not. One might make a judgment call as to whether or not this should be allowed or not. That might be another question that one has. But there are certain factual scientific matters, and that's why I think there needs to be an expert base. But I certainly am not arguing for those people to be of any particular cultural, gender, or racial diversity, and I am very in favor of a multiple you know, expression of those decision making being across the board, so we can again get decisions that are made that are reflective of a bit of the diversity of our society as well. And I think that's one of the key challenges. And if I may say an ending, you know, point to the committee, I think we really do need to define in post-apartheid South Africa what approach are we going to adopt towards non-human animals in our legislation, in our policy. It's an important matter. We also blessed in South Africa for the richness. President Mbeki famously in his I'm an African speech spoke really eloquently about the fact that he even considered conferring citizenship on the lion and the leopard, right? And it's very interesting, and I think it's very key that we grapple with what approach are we going to adopt in our society on these important matters, and I hope it will be one that is embracing and compassionate and reflective of a deep respect for the other creatures with whom we share our beautiful country. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Professor. I am now going to call the second presenter from National Council of SPCA, Andrew Fernet. And will be followed by EMS Foundation. Michael, take over. taken your 5 minutes. You've noticed.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will attempt to be very brief and very quick. Good morning, House. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to make this presentation. As you heard, I'm Andrew Spencer. I'm a Senior Inspector for the National Council of SPCAs. I'll be presenting our comments on the current draft bill for the Performing Animals Protection Act. Just a quick introduction on the NSPCA. We're there to prevent animal cruelty across the board. Our role and function is legislation, majority of it. We also work with the industry to set up standards. We are a non-profit organization. We're a statutory body in terms of the SPCA Act. The SPCAs across the country enforces about 90% of animal welfare legislation currently. Vast majority of the cases are resolved with cooperation and advice. Just to give you a little bit of background, the reason why the NSPCA took the case to the Constitutional Court was we identified that there was a lack of knowledge through magistrates issuing licenses across the country. Also, magistrates were being abused by applicants. If the one magistrate refused to issue a license, he jumps to another magistrate, and that magistrate would issue a license. And that license was then valid either nationally or locally, depending on how the magistrate interpreted it. So we felt that the legislation needed to be revised. Some of the exhibitions and performances posed harm to animals and were still allowed to go ahead through the magistrates issuing those licenses. And there was a severe lack of consultation by magistrates with experts or skilled people in the relevant areas. We then were advised by our legal teams that the Act was old and that function is an administrative function, just like the liquor license, and a better system needed to be put in place. The Constitutional Court then is essentially ruled only on Sections 2 and 3 as far as where it relates to magistrates. And hence, the Department of Agriculture was then, through Parliament, instructed to concentrate their efforts on those two areas, which is Sections 2 and 3. We do agree with the previous speaker that the whole Act does need revision. However, looking at the timeline, looking at what's put before the committee, we confining our comments in terms of Section 2 and 3 of the Act, but we will take questions and comments on other parts as well. The purpose of the Act is to prevent animals from suffering. It's to protect performing animals. They cannot speak for themselves. Therefore, it also relates to public protection. If an animal is scared or something happens, the public is put in danger. And if you have incompetent handlers, unacceptable methods of training or handling, these performances become cruel. Certain sections of the Act also makes provision that the handler or the performance needs to provide for safety to the public. So to ensure that animals are performed in public spaces and to protect those animals, the Act makes provision for the magistrates currently to ensure that the competent person handles and controls those animals, and therefore providing safety to the public as a secondary purpose. Animal welfare is a complex subject. The Act's purpose is to protect the animals in performances and dogs for safeguarding. Would the licensing officer, which currently as it is put forward would be either a state vet or the veterinary technicians, have the necessary knowledge base? We've attended several workshops with DAF where it is identified that there is a skills shortage within DAS. Welfare is not currently a mandate for state vets, and skilled person with experience and knowledge therefore have to be part of the licensing and appeal process to assist those officers issuing those licenses. Therefore, the amendments to the Act, I'm going to go into details. Section 3B, we would like to see that in front of or just after 3A, it needs to be inserted that must have animal welfare experience, and B. I know the question was what level of expertise is needed, but experience is very, very important in the field of animal welfare. The PAPA is read with as one with the Animals Protection Act. Therefore, any animal cruelty is already a criminal offence. And this Act is supposed to be read with the Animals Protection Act. So it's two acts read as one. How does one do that currently? It's up to magistrates to decide when the matter is taken to court. But for an issuing license officer, they need to understand how this works. Animal welfare experience is important to understand that animals need to prevent animals from becoming distressed or dangerous. A person issuing a license needs to understand what is going to happen to that animal and whether the person that is going to handle those animals, perform with those animals, would be able to provide for the welfare of that animal as well as the safety around it. And if you're not experienced or an expert in the field, you're not going to know what to look for, what questions to ask. And that is our motivation behind the fact that there needs to be wording placed in that section that says must have animal welfare experience. The next amendment, 3C1, the National Licensing Officer may in a manner that is not inconsistent with the Act or the regulations. We would like the word must to be added in front of request so that it reads that must request from any person or organization subject to the Promotion of Access to Information Act any information that may be required to enable the licensing officer to consider an application for a license. And that comes down to not only welfare, but it comes down to environmental affairs as well as wild animals. It's no... If a licensing officer is going to issue a license for lions or elephants in KZN to be performed, and that license is valid elsewhere in the country, but that licensing officer doesn't consult with the Department of Environmental Affairs on the permits needed for those animals or where those animals are coming from, then it's going to clash with the provincial legislations. This has already happened where we've made representations on wild animals with magistrates, where there was a debate between whether the Performing Animals Protection Act overrides any provincial permit issuing. And people have gotten, zoos have gotten away with it in the past. So there must be a request from any person or organization subject to the Promotion of Access to Information Act on any information that may be required to enable the licensing officer to consider an application. Delegation of powers and functions in terms of 3E1, the licensing officer may delegate any of his or her functions under this Act to an expert or other person appointed in terms of Section 3D. We'd like to insert, after the end of that sentence, except for the issuing, granting, or reinstating of a license. The motivation is that to ensure that the granting or issuing and reinstating is centralized with the National Licensing Officer. That is the biggest problem we had with magistrates. Applicants jump from one person to another. They jump from province to province. They jump from town to town, anywhere where they can get a license. We do not have a problem with a local officer accepting the applications, but the actual scrutiny and issuing and granting needs to be centralized at a national office to prevent the bias issues and to prevent from people jumping around. Section 3F1A, consideration and granting of applications for licenses by national licensing officer. We would like to insert at the beginning of 3F1 and B the following and inspections to the premises. It is important that the and that is what we as the SPCA have been doing. Those magistrates that did ask for reports and did ask us for information, we physically, at no cost to the applicant or the magistrate, went out and we physically inspected the facilities. There were very few facilities where we had problems with, but there were facilities that we made recommendations to, and the magistrates then entered those conditions into those applications. So there has to be a physical inspection of where the animals are being trained, kept, housed, or performed. To insert after act under 3F1A, so that it will read, he or she is satisfied that the information furnished by the applicant as contemplated by section 3H2 is in accordance with the purpose of this act, and after having published such application for a period of 30 days for public comment in the Government Gazette. The motivation behind that is it will allow the licensing officer to make an informed decision as to whether the public will have a problem with that performance, as we have with in an Eastern Cape town where certain performances are not allowed in that town. So people should have the right to say whether they want that performance or not. It will also allow organizations, not only the SPCA, but other organizations to make representation on individual applications. 3H1 must apply to the national licensing officer for the district in which the permanent address of the applicant is situated and must pay the prescribed fee. The problem here, as with magistrates, is the applicants will apply elsewhere, as I've stated before. It has to be centralized. Section 3H2A, an application for a license in terms of this act must be in writing and must include the following information. After description, we would like to see the wording inserted that a description of the animal that the applicant intends to exhibit or train for exhibition or use for safeguarding, with microchip details of that animal that the applicant intends to use. We also would like to insert sections F, species, variety or class of animals, and number per species, variety or class that the applicant intends to exhibit or train for exhibition or use for safeguarding. G, a new section, age of animal that the applicant intends to exhibit. H, the methods of training the animal or animals intended to be used for exhibition, training, exhibition or use for safeguarding. I, the equipment, measures and methods used for control, restraint and training of animals to be used for exhibition. J, vehicles or means of transport in which animals are kept, confined or being transported for the purpose of exhibition or trained for exhibition, or in which dogs used for safeguarding are maintained, kept or confined. All these are currently contained in Regulation 1672 that is part of the current Act, where the applicants have to declare these to the magistrates. We would like this to be written into the actual law so that this becomes not just a regulation or a standard, but that this is enforceable. Section 3H2C, to insert the underline after the end of the sentence, so that the sentence will read a description of the general nature of the safeguarding in which the animal is intended to be used, and details of the location of the safeguarding and exhibition and training. That is a sore point in some industries. because they have what we call cyclists, where security companies, especially safeguarding dogs, are used across the country. And we have found problems on those specific sites. So the company or the applicant may not be a problem, but where the animals are going to be stationed and used by that specific security officer may be a problem. And we need to be able to, that needs to be listed in as part of the application as to where those animals are going to be used and how they're going to be kept at those sites. Section 3H2E currently reads meal plans and general practices that the applicant will follow to maintain and ensure the health and well-being of the animals. After meal plans, we would like to have the wording transportation and general practices to be included as well. So it will read in the end, meal plans, transportation, and general practices, including veterinary contact details that the applicant will follow to maintain and ensure the health and well-being of the animal. Section 3H2F, the number of hours per day that the animal will be required to perform, be exhibited, trained to be exhibited, or for safeguarding. To insert after safeguarding and time of transportation, that is one of the biggest problems we have with some security companies is the security officers knock off at 6 a.m. with their dogs. The dogs then remain in those traveling vehicles for the rest of the day until they start their next shift at 6 p.m. because those same vehicles are used to pick up and drop guard all over the town or the locations. And those dogs are then rested, but they rested in transportation, which is not an acceptable form of rest for those animals because they are constantly moving around. And then we would like to insert two new subsections under Section 3H2E to read H. National South African Police Clearance Certificate. Currently, Regulation 1672 allows the magistrate to ask for a national, for a police letter stating that the person is competent to handle those animals. That was in 1935. That no longer is valid because the police now issues clearance certificates. And for any person to establish whether that person do not have animal cruelty convictions against him, a police clearance certificate needs to be requested by the licensing officer. And then a disaster management report from the local district or municipal disaster management commander. That is very important because some of these performances include large crowds of people that will come and look at the local elephant and lion show. But there is no disaster management input from those local towns or from the person wanting to use those animals. That needs to become part of this legislation. We would also like to the word may to be deleted and insert must. An inspection must be undertaken of those facilities. And then to insert a new subsection under 3H, should a license be refused?
Can you summarize? Your minutes are gone.
Sure. Right. To summarize, we would like the licensing procedure to be centralized, and we would like the licensing officers or whoever accepts those applications to be able to draw in experts to call for information so that the information that he has before him will enable him to make an informed, unbiased decision as to those applications can be approved or not. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm now going to call upon EMA Foundation. Over to you, ma'am. We have joined by Honourable Member Nwabe. Can you just raise a hand so that the stakeholders can see? And the Honourable Kinge Mabe.
And providing dignity. We want to state up front that we support totally the SIFAC submission, so I'm not going to go into the details of the act. Both the Animal Protection Act and the Performing Animals Protection Act provide the foundation for animal welfare and protection legislation in South Africa and fall under the control of the Department of Agriculture. There's an urgent need for more progressive animal protection legislation in South Africa. So in our view, this review process should provide the opportunity to amend the Performing Animal Protection Act in its entirety, but also should give an opportunity to relook at the Animal Protection Act, because both of these pieces of legislation are hopelessly out of date. They're not protecting animals. And further, they're not aligned with South Africa's constitutional and democratic order or with advancements in the scientific and ecological understanding of animals. The promulgation of more progressive policies and laws in other countries are not reflected in our legislation. Moreover, there's strong scientific evidence reflecting the link between violence perpetrated by humans against humans and humans against other animals. In a country beset by so much violence against people and animals, government bodies should be promoting humane and non-violent methods of engaging with wildlife. Also, there was a very big workshop a few years ago where there were a number of animal welfare and protection organizations, and at that workshop they were all in agreement that there was an urgent need for legislative reform, because both these pieces of legislation, the APA and PAPA, are both outdated colonial and apartheid pieces of legislation. And although both acts fall under the Department of Agriculture, it appears that that department has no jurisdiction to investigate cruelty or to take action against cruelty. Instead, and worryingly, it is outsourced solely to NGOs. This is an untenable situation. There are also critical weaknesses with regard to both pieces of legislation in terms of interpretation, application, administration, locus standi, enforcement, investigative, and trained personnel provisions. More generally, there is also inadequate protection for wildlife in the current animal protection legislation, particularly in relation to hunting, to so-called culling, predators held in the cans hunting industry, so-called damaging, causing animals, animals in captivity, and then the issue of res nullius. There's no synergy with other relevant pieces of pertinent legislation. For example, environmental legislation, such as the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, including their various norms and standards that fall under it. So what needs to happen is that the pieces of animal protection legislation and environmental legislation need to be brought into synergy with one another. Currently, that is not the case. Conservation officials are the entities that provide permits for wild animals to be captured and moved, and this has massive welfare implications. yet environmental legislation does not mention any of the animal protection legislation, the APA or PAPA. At the very least, permits for the movement of wild animals and the permits allowing animals to be held need to be substantially more specific in terms of welfare and protection requirements and include conditions which facilitate welfare inspection. Our foundation wants to make a very specific intervention in relation to elephants at these hearings. And this is because the captive elephant industry obtains licenses in terms of PAPA for their activities, i.e. for training, display, riding, and interaction. But this act is not protecting elephants in captivity. There is a lack of clarity in terms of which government department is actually responsible for the keeping and management of elephants in captivity. Despite the fact that there are two government departments who are theoretically mandated to take responsibility for elephants in captivity, the reality is that government has dropped the ball in terms of the protection, welfare, and interests of elephants. Current research undertaken by ourselves recently has revealed that information about elephants in captivity in South Africa, including any statistics, records on individual elephants, their movements, locations, an audit, a census, etc., is not known or kept by national or provincial governments, including by the Department of Agriculture or by the Department of Environmental Affairs. The industry itself is not organized and does not have this information. Through our investigative research, we believe there are about 129 elephants in captivity in South Africa. They are owned by 22 private individuals or companies and two state entities, being the Johannesburg Zoo and the National Zoological Gardens of Pretoria. Five individuals or companies own 53% of these elephants. We can provide you with a copy of the census if you'd like to see it, and also we'd be grateful if you have any input or additional information that you could give to us. Almost every elephant in captivity in South Africa, except for the few that have been born in captive facilities, has been taken from the wild as babies or juveniles, kidnapped from their families and forcibly removed from them. In the main, the captive elephant industry operates largely within an unfettered environment. No legislation exists in South Africa that governs the methods used in training elephants. So why this concern for elephants? Well, they're highly social. They have the largest social network of any mammal yet studied other than humans. There is a huge amount of research on their biology and behavior, and we are learning more about them every day. Recent studies show that humans and elephants share the same attributes, once thought unique to humans. For example, emotions, agency, consciousness, complex cognitive abilities, capacity to grieve, vocal learning, and of course intelligence, as well as traits such as fear, attachment and social bonding, pain, aggression, anxiety, and facial recognition. The latest research has proved that elephants have a sense of self-awareness, placing them in a unique category together with great apes, dolphins, and humans. The susceptibility of elephants to post-traumatic stress disorder has been demonstrated, and they are extremely vulnerable to suffering, especially in a captive setting. What we have learned about elephants means that we are confronting very real ethical issues in relation to our current policies and legislation that affects them. Indeed, the way we treat elephants is also placing the very character of South Africans at issue. Also, globally, there's huge concern for the well-being of elephants in captivity, particularly in relation to abuses of elephants which are attributable to the captive elephant industry, including capture of juvenile elephants from wild family groups, cruel training methods, the conditions in which the elephants are kept, and the safety of people handling them. Several recent high-profile cases, both locally and abroad, have brought to light a number of concerns regarding the welfare of elephants in captivity, particularly in relation to so-called training. Training typically involves the use of physical punishment. These elephant abuse cases, coupled with the prevalence of elephant handler injury and death, have led to elephant handling methods being called into serious question. The captured elephant industry has a history in South Africa of cruel, abusive, and domination training and deaths of handlers. The use of elephants in the elephant-back safari industry is not only highly detrimental to elephants, but it also increases the risk of injury for personnel as well as the general public. In South Africa, the training and keeping of elephants in captivity persists without adequate monitoring and control. As far back as 2005, a number of local and international animal protection organizations warned that South Africa can ill afford a rapidly growing captive elephant industry sliding out of control, but this is precisely what has happened. There's also high demand for young elephants for use in the industry in South Africa. Consequently, there have been a number of captures of wild juvenile elephants from their families for commercial use in captivity. This practice has long been recognized by elephant scientists and experts as unacceptable, and it is highly traumatic for both the captured individuals and obviously their remaining family members. It is also contrary to South African National Parks policy. Once captured, elephants used in the elephant-back safari industry and in circuses are subjected to absolute control, social and physical deprivation, and in most cases, psychological and physical violence. The elephant-back safari industry, circuses, and zoos employ a dominance-based free contact approach to elephant control. This involves a variety of tools and methods that cause intense distress, pain, injury, and are employed to limit elephant behavior and movement. So bull hooks, which is a wooden pole with curved metal hooks at one end, they're used to inflict pain on sensitive areas of the elephants for the purpose of breaking them. It's a long-held tradition that is grounded in principles of physical and emotional coercion to obtain absolute control. Typically, the breaking process begins with the removal of infants from their family units, followed by bodily immobilization, beating, and starvation, until the elephant accepts the trainer as his or her master. Negative reinforcement techniques are part of regular training, so bull hook beatings for poor performance, displays of resistance, and or unapproved socialization with other elephants. The power handlers exert over the elephants is psychologically corrosive because they play the dual role of the agent of captivity and abuse, and of attachment and survival. So the relationship always involves the potential for repeated trauma, fear, and harm. So early trauma, chronic stress, and deprivation are common to elephants in captivity. The added stress and trauma exerted by such practices as beating, negative reinforcement, chaining, physical abuse, and social isolation further undermines their well-being. And this transmits laterally among other elephants, but also vertically across generations. The experience of elephants in captivity is equivalent to that of many human prisoners and victims of torture. We have a well-documented South African insight into the elephant training methods, the so-called Thule elephant case, where 30 juvenile elephants between the ages of 2 and 5 were kidnapped from their families and abused for use by zoos, circuses, and the elephant-back safari industry. The Thule elephant case starkly illustrates the weaknesses in the Animal Protection Act, which, for example, does not outlaw the beating and restraining of wild animals. The elephant owner was not barred from owning, handling, or selling elephants, and the life nature of the conviction sent a message to wildlife dealers and elephant trainers that in South Africa, abuse of animals is encouraged. In 2000, the magistrate in the Thule case admitted that the Animal Protection Act was confusing and urged that it be redrafted to bring it into line with international legislation and best practice relating to animal welfare and protection. This has not happened. Below are some, well, I'm going to show you some pictures of the so-called training that happens in South Africa. This is one of the Thule elephants. That's just a Thule elephant, the little one. These are recent cases. I'm just going to go through quickly because I know it's for time. But just to give you an idea of the training methods that are happening in our country. You can see they're all young, juvenile elephants. Right. I want to stress the issue around human injuries and death in the captive elephant industry. Research shows that captivity causes severe trauma and stress in elephants, and therefore it endangers human safety. To minimize the probability of human injury or death from an elephant, it is necessary to avoid two things, the very two things that we don't do. Humans in close proximity with elephants, and also subjecting elephants to conditions that will threaten or cause stress. Captivity and associated commercial activities do both. There have been a number of serious injuries and incidents to both tourists and handlers, including deaths in South Africa. Not all of these are recorded, and many are kept under wraps by owners paying off handlers and out-of-court settlements with tourists. In addition, the insurance companies are loading policies. In other words, it's becoming very difficult for these companies to actually insure their workers. And actually, some companies are actually refusing to insure against these kinds of injuries. Also, in terms of the workers in the industry, they're not organized in any way, and most of the workers come from Zimbabwe. In closing, to allow elephants to continue to be captured, trained, and used in the so-called free contact interaction would mean to ignore scientific truths, to condone inhumane treatment of elephants, and to ignore the growing trend away from this sort of horrific practice. Prevention of use in elephants in captivity will not have a significant economic or negative tourism impact. In fact, I think in terms of tourism, it will have the opposite. South Africa should be, at the very least, implementing the conclusions reached by consensus at the Captive Elephant Working Group workshop, which was organized by the Department of Environmental Affairs in 2007. And those included, capture from the wild for captivity must be prohibited, import and export of elephants for captivity must be prevented, captive breeding of existing elephants in captivity must be prevented, there should be an audit of all existing elephants in captivity to assess their situation and whether possible to return them to the wild or semi-wild. So-called free contact situations of elephants in captivity should be prohibited. All training for free contact interaction with elephants should be stopped. And the use of all training methods and tools that are inhumane should be prohibited. Also, self-regulation by those who use elephants should not be allowed. There should also be effective independent monitoring of all elephants in captivity. The issuing of licenses and permits to keep and use elephants in captivity must be overseen by a committee whose members are drawn from the animal protection and welfare sector and internationally accredited and respected elephant behavioral ethologists and scientists. Surely it is not acceptable to say that elephants have been tamed and trained in harsh ways for centuries and therefore it is justifiable to continue to do so. It is similar to someone saying in the mid-1800s that slavery existed for thousands of years and therefore there is no reason to abolish it. We fail in our humanity when we treat other animals so unkindly. We are appealing to your committee to intervene and to ensure that our animal protection legislation is appropriately overhauled so that not only the elephants in captivity, but all animals in our care are properly protected. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. You've been on board and you've managed your time very well. Thank you very much. We'll now go to the animal trainer, Mr. Lou. Please, Lou.
Recording. Okay, there we go. All right.
We have switched off your mic.
Sorry. Okay. All right. With one qualification, I've listened and I knew that this was actually going to happen, but with one qualification, we support the submissions by EMS, by MSPCA, and by SIFAC, that the welfare, that processes need to be in place so that the welfare of the animals needs to be monitored very, very carefully in our country. The qualification that we have is that we submit, Ban Animal Trading submits, that any committee that is tasked with granting and issuing proper permits should have at least one member representing the rights of animals on that committee. Just a little bit of background as to who we are. Ban Animal Trading is a registered non-profit company. We educate and create awareness about the plight of animals, and we mostly focus on animal protection issues in South Africa. Obviously, if something happens internationally, we will recognize what is going on and so on and focus on that, but our aim is basically to further awareness and education about animals in South Africa. Our organization, as you can see and as the name implies, is an animal rights organization, and we are particularly opposed to the commercialization of animals. So we're talking circus, we're talking zoo, we're talking pet shops, anything where animals become commodities and you can swap them around as you would a faulty stove or a broken fridge. That is what we are absolutely against. In the submission, we would like to focus on animals used for commercial gain in circuses specifically. It's a very wide one. We, as I said in the beginning, we approve of and we support what the other people have said, especially cross-cultures, because they're including reptiles and aquatic animals. And we want to focus specifically on the circus. The public hearings on the Performing Animals Protection Amendment Law provide Ban Animal Trading with the opportunity to propose the moral, ethical, and ultimately the next legislative step that should be taken to protect animals against the abuse of exploitation for commercial entertainment in South Africa. And we propose an unqualified ban on the use of all animals in circuses. The most contentious issue relating to the issuing of proper permits must indeed be the exploitation of animals in the circus for entertainment. These animals are not the only animals used in the entertainment industry. We know about the aquariums, we know about the zoos, live animal exhibitions, caged bird shows, we know about shows that happen at any, you know, like for example the Rand Easter Show and so on. All of these are different animals and we're not talking circus animals only. For the purposes of this ambition, and as mentioned, precisely because animal exploitation for entertainment is the most contentious issue, the submission focuses only on animals used in the circus for entertainment. The plight of circus animals is a worldwide problem, and I'm sure that most people have been following, it's been international news, and not only news for animal rights and animal welfare people, but international news everywhere that circuses are starting to see the light in a way, and that they are now letting, and the governments are getting legislation in place that bans and prohibits the use of wild animals, and some countries have even prohibit the use of all animals in the circus. And these are the following developments that have occurred recently, just to give you an idea of what is happening internationally. Several countries in Europe, including Austria, Belgium, and the Netherlands, now prohibit the use of wild animals. And if wild animals, we talk about lions and tigers and elephants. Two countries, Greece and Malta, have prohibited the use of all animals in circuses. In Australia, several councils or areas, including Perth, have banned the use of wild animals in the circus. In Canada, we have more than 28 municipalities banning the use of wild animals in circuses, and so the trend continues in Central and South America. Ban Animal Trading believes that South Africa, which is a country with one of the most advanced constitutions in the world, must not only be part of the international trend in which the inherent dignity of animals is recognized and respected, but we should at least lead the way. When President Nelson Mandela signed the 1991 Constitution into law at Sharpeville on 10 December 1996, he brought to a close a long and bitter struggle to establish democracy in our country. It was a statement of our country's determination to turn our back on a path that was marked by racism and a gross violation of human rights. Our constitution protects the dignity of every single human in this country, and it also includes the dignity and rights of sentenced prisoners who have violated the very norms of our society, and sometimes in a most terrible, terrible manner. The Constitution is a remarkable document because it fuses the apex of African and Western intellectual achievement with African wisdom. Underlying the Constitution is the concept of Ubuntu, which refers to the state of human oneness. Human oneness includes the unity of humans, animals, and the natural world, and this means recognizing and respecting the rights and the dignity of all animals. Respecting an animal's rights does not mean that we subordinate our own interests, the interests of humans, to those of the animals, any more than respecting human rights means letting people take advantage of you. It does mean looking at ways and looking for ways of resolving conflicts of interest that consider animals' interests, especially the interests essential to their nature. Animals used in the entertainment industry are denied all opportunities to express their natural behavior. And as a result, captive animals in the entertainment industry become frustrated, and they suffer extreme stress and boredom and can lash out at humans at any time. There are many examples worldwide of humans being killed and being injured by animals in the circus. And in South Africa, we are aware of the following incidents. There may have been more, but these are the ones that we are aware of. In 2001, a handler was killed by a circus elephant on a film set in Bruderstrom. In 2013, an alligator escaped from his or her circus enclosure in Port Elizabeth. And only last year, in 2014, we all read in the newspaper about a circus worker who sustained severe bite wounds to his neck and his chest when he was attacked by a tiger, a circus tiger. Animals in the circus spend most of their days in confinement, and they are only taken out of their cages or exercise tents, which are much, much smaller than the standard that applies to the enclosures, the outside enclosures of animals in zoos, when they have to train or perform. And now the training methods, which Michelle also referred to, are questionable. And training of circus animals in South Africa happens behind closed doors. We have, as an animal rights organization, been invited to go and have a look at the training that happens at the two circuses that have wild animals. But we know that what they are going to show us is not what is happening behind closed doors and how these animals are trained in reality. Footage is available of training methods used by circuses internationally, and this shows the beating of animals, shackling with iron chains and using electric prods and whips to install in them conduct that is absolutely and totally against their nature. We have no reason to believe that the animals in South Africa are trained any differently. We have heard claims from the animal circuses in this country that only positive reinforcement is used as a training method. If this were true, we have to ask why whips are carried around by trainers while the animals are performing, because the tools of the trade indicate the nature of the training method. So if it's only training, if it's only positive reinforcement, we would expect people in the arena to walk around with bags of treats, because that is positive reinforcement, not with whips and threatening and scaring the animals. And this, obviously, we know is not so. We are also aware that a charge of animal cruelty has been laid against one of the animal circuses in South Africa after video footage was made public showing an elephant being beaten by a staff member of this specific circus. A 2009 scientific review published in the International Animal Welfare Journal concludes that the species of non-domestic animals, which would be wild animals, no matter whether they are captive-born or not, commonly kept in circuses appear the least suited to a circus life. So these would be, again, once again, the lions, the tigers, the elephants, and so on. The circus plays no role whatsoever in conservation, and it has no educational purpose. The circus only teaches children that magnificent creatures can be reduced to pathetic beings jumping through hoops and sitting on bar stools. The animals are lumped together in the experienced world of children with clowns and humans who can do tricks. The circus does not promote the oneness and unity of humans with nature. And the research shows that animals are conscious, emotional, sentient beings to the same degree as humans. In fact, an international group of prominent scientists in 2012 signed the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, which recognizes the sentient nature of all animals. Entertainment is a luxury, and the use of sentient beings to amuse small children cannot be ethically or morally justified. While we agree that the welfare of animals currently in the entertainment industry is of utmost importance, the simplistic notion that we as humans act ethically when animals are not treated cruelly is flawed. It's actually our obligations as humans go much, much further than this. The notion that the prohibition of overtly cruel conduct is all that the legislature is obliged to achieve describes our obligations to animals solely in terms of what is prohibited, but it is silent on our positive obligations to them. Secondly, the notion assumes that animal abuse is a matter of intentional cruelty. Intentional cruelty must unquestionably be criminalized, and as we've heard from Bolshev and the NSPCA, this is already in the APA Act. Most importantly, well-meaning exploitation of animals in circuses must at all costs be avoided, and this can only be achieved by a blanket ban on the use of all animals for entertainment in the circus. Ban Animal Trading proposes that in keeping with international changes and for the reasons set out above, a total ban be placed on the use of all animals for entertainment in the circus. And in closing, I just want to quote a research fellow in moral philosophy, Dr. Elisa Altola, and she said, and this sums up where we come from perfectly. Taking all these considerations, welfare, value, and understandings of animals into account, forces us to acknowledge that animal circuses lack moral justification. They infringe on the welfare of animals. They do not take into account basic moral considerations, and they present a misleading understanding of animals. Legislation ought to reflect these considerations, and animal circuses ought to be banned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll now call SA Dog Academy, Mr. Nicholas Manley.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I just want to find out, you've allocated an hour. Is that correct?
Hour for who?
For me.
No.
No. I don't want you to
no, you
offer
have only,
you. Rush
you only have 25 minutes.
Only 30 minutes?
25 minutes.
Oh, 25. Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
And already you've eaten one.
Yes. Madam Chair, I was involved with the stakeholders meeting last year in May in Pretoria, and then at another meeting we had last week. And I was rather surprised to see many of the stakeholders that have already spoken were not present there. I do agree with what they say, up to a point. Training, the forced method, there's a forced method of training. There's the bribery method of training, using food and other enticements. There's a repetitive form of training and reinforcement. There's the playing method, where you use toys And then, of course, there's a master dog method, which depends on the hearing of the animal. I'm not going to go into detail with that, but I just thought I'll mention, we as humans, we are also trained all the time, and I don't know what method the government uses, but I would say it's the force method, because if I do something wrong, I normally have a fine or imprisonment. So we have to abide by certain laws. On behalf of my company, SADA Access Control, we trade as SA Dog Academy, amongst other things. The security industry, under the control of CIRA, we don't mention the P, it's PSIRA, Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority. SANSEA, who's an employer organization in the security industry, the South African National Security Employers Association. It is my intention, and I've mentioned this in previous times, that the use of animal for safeguarding be excluded from your proposed amendment. My reasons are as follows. Prior to 1989, the various security companies and the above-mentioned associations, together with the NSPCA representatives, had agreed to proposed regulations for guard dogs and handlers. Addendum A, which I've distributed to the Secretary, mentions there that, amongst others, Mr. Mike French and Mr. Hans Milieu from the NSPCA were present. Unfortunately, Mr. Mike French passed away. And it was agreed, that these proposed regulations be submitted to the Department of Justice for inclusion into the Animal Welfare Act. And the Security Officers Board at that time, CIRA, formulated the minimum standards, which were under Board Notice 120 of 1998, the establishment of training standards for security dogs and handlers. And this was per Government Gazette 19067 of 24th of July 1987. And an amendment. Now, previous speakers made mention of PAPA Act, the Animal Protection Act, but they failed to mention this particular act. These standards adequately covers the approved NSPCA proposed regulations for guard dogs. You also notice that Mr. Hans Milieu from the NSPCA actually thanked myself for the hard work. Now, it wasn't hard work, it was very easy work, because that is exactly how we operated a training dog supply standard to our establishment. So I just covered everything that the company does and I passed it on. I didn't insist on any copyright to it. So there was a very good relationship, and those two gentlemen, plus another gentleman from the NSPCA, certainly cover aspects that previous speakers have mentioned that the new act must always have a animal welfare officer available for licensing. Unfortunately, the cordial relationship and trust between the two groups was completely severed when the NSPCA went directly to the Department of Justice and gave the latter a different interpretation of our agreement as per paragraph number one. with the result that our industry was just added to the Papa Act as a last resort. We actually joked about it. We have got circus dogs now. The comparison of the details of the addendum 1 and 2 documents or paragraphs confirms that CIRA had adhered to what was agreed with the NSPCA and that the old Papa Act bears no resemblance to what the NSPCA had wanted. I just want to break away for those of you that don't know about the Act. Under accreditation requirements, this is in the Act, the dog training center, it mentions the size of the kennel, to have proper drainage, ventilation, access to water, dry storage facilities for food and cleaning materials. Practical training areas. They must have access to different required training areas such as open training area for obedience and agility workers. The reason why it must be open and flat is so that the handlers don't trip. The other thing I just want to break away from, we don't train dogs. Dogs are, they get by. We train people. In actual fact, sometimes we've actually got special dogs for training methods and training purposes. There must be buildings, a shopping centers. In other words, a dog cannot just look for a criminal in the open area. It must go into buildings, shopping centers, factories, especially nice, noisy factories. Training equipment. Must have access to agility equipment. In other words, everything is not just a flat piece of ground. They must be able to move over objects. Sound-producing devices. And then the protection equipment for the, what we would call the criminal. And number four, veterinary services, have access to veterinary services for purpose care of the sick, injured animals. Number five, it says they're SOB accredited, that's now PSIRA accredited, instructors and training personnel. You can't just say you're a dog trainer. You have to go to a course and you work with prior knowledge, ex-police, ex-army. We have great difficulty with them sometimes because they've got such ingrained different ideas and wrong ideas. All instructors must be certified by the Security Officers Board with PSIRA. That is the training center.
Summarize, you are left with 1 minute.
Am I left with 1 minute?
Yes.
It's gone so quickly. Madam Chair, there are a few things I must comment on. The reason why we are here is because of the Concord decision. During the Concord decision, the legal advisors of the SPCA conceded that they are biased. That has been conveniently forgotten or not mentioned earlier. We are members of LATA, which is the Licensed Animal Training Association, and I must apologize that the circus people are not here. There was a misunderstanding as far as timing is concerned. Then I would like in the Act, by the way, I did mention to DAF this morning that we will abide by the Papa Act. So although we say in my speech we said we want to be excluded, if we are not excluded, then we strongly propose that all dog or animal training facilities be incorporated in Papa. That includes the police and welfare organizations, their kennels as well. The committee should do themselves a favor and visit welfare organization kennels, and they will be shocked at times. There's the other thing that is very much close to our heart, and that is under the regulations, Now, I assume regulations are similar to the Act. It's a part of the law. The movement of animals, the record movement for animals, we propose that in our industry that the record movement is a record. In other words, you can do it after the period of movement. This is just in the event of any illegal act, and we want to identify a particular dog. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I now call upon the South African Veterinary Association, Dr. J. Ashton. Okay. You're welcome, Doctor.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of the South African Veterinary Association, I would like to express our thanks for having an opportunity to make this verbal submission. Now, the Performing Animal Protection Act is legislation which is now more than 70 years old. It was brought into this country really by in a time when the country was really under governance by and under the influence of governance by Great Britain. So it seems to be a very old legislation. And in the 40 years that I've been involved with animal welfare in the South African Veterinary Association, it's been very apparent that it has not adequately provided the function of protecting the interests of animals used for performances, for entertainment, and for many other purposes. This has also been a great thorn in the side of the NSPCA, and very commendably they took this issue to the Constitutional Court to unseat the magistrates as the adjudicating officers in this particular act. And quite rightly so, because I can't think of anybody less qualified to adjudicate license applications than a magistrate, simply because his academic training and the nature of the work that he does is totally divorced from the issues that need to be evaluated. Now, what in essence is of interest to us is that we have now an old act in which two sections have been repealed and one has been redrafted. And in essence, this is very much like taking an old motor car and putting new parts on it and expecting it to function like a new motor car. Clearly what should have been done is we should have applied our minds to the redrafting of a new act. But logistical reasons have dictated really that this was the only workable option in view of resources which were available. And so the Department of Agriculture and Fisheries have in fact redrafted the bill, the section of the bill which we're looking at today. Now, I think that what they have done is commendable under the circumstances. And what is done in the redrafting of the bill is that it has made the South African Veterinary Association and veterinarians in South Africa formally stakeholders in the administration of the Performing Animal Protection Act. And we welcome this because indeed the main reason for the existence of the veterinary profession is the health and welfare of animals. And indeed it is a great concern to us to see the level of animal abuse and unnecessary suffering which is inflicted on animals in our society in South Africa. Now, the crux of the matter in making veterinarians part of the adjudication process in the draft bill is the appropriateness of our profession to officiate as the adjudicators of animal welfare. Section 3B of the amendment bill describes the National Licensing Officer
must either be a veterinary or an animal scientist registered with their respective statutory councils. In the case of the veterinary profession, the registration is with the South African Veterinary Council and is subject to the applicant being the holder of prescribed academic qualifications recognised by the council. And part of this qualification includes the successful completion of recognised courses in veterinary jurisprudence, professional ethics, and animal ethics, and welfare ethics. And veterinarians registered with the South African Veterinary Council are furthermore obliged to observe and comply with the code of conduct specified in the rules of the Veterinary and Paraveterinary Professions Act. In particular, in part two of the rules in section 4 under general principles, it stated that a veterinary professional shall base his conduct thereon that he and she will not permit himself or herself to be exploited in a manner which may be detrimental to an animal, to his or her clients, or to the profession. And in what this really means, that veterinarians may not permit themselves to be exploited in a manner which will unfairly or unjustifiably harm cause harm to an animal, to a client, or to a profession. And so this puts veterinarians in a very difficult situation where they have to adjudicate the interests of three different groups. But what is perhaps important over here is the exploitation. Now, the harm which is caused to animals by humans in society stems really from five things, from ignorance, from indifference, it stems from insensitivity, from greed, and from power. And for this morning we saw a presentation by Michelle Pickover over here on the training of elephants, and the entertainment provided by trained elephants is really the entertainment of a human exercising power of a very strong and powerful animal. And strangely, human nature in our society likes to see that. But indeed, it does cause serious harm to the animals, both in the training and the question really is whether they actually have good lives. Now, clearly the purpose of the Performing Animal Protection Act is the protection of animals, and as such, only persons who are qualified to make judgments in considering applications for licenses in terms of the Act should be appointed to do so. The Amendment Bill makes provision for the appointment of experts to assist the National Licensing Officer and to whom his or her functions may be delegated. To be consistent, this would imply that only a person equally qualified to perform the duties of National Licensing Officer should be legally entitled to perform these functions, the delegated functions. In other words, the duties should only be delegated to veterinarians, and this requirement is not clearly specified in the Performing Animal Protection Act. The South African Veterinary Association in South Africa represents professional body of veterinarians, and the values of veterinary profession are embodied in its credo, which states, amongst other things, that we, the members of the South African Veterinary Association, resolve at all times to use our knowledge, skills, and resources to protect and promote the health and welfare of animals and humans. And this statement really affirms that the reason for the existence of the veterinary profession is the health and welfare of animals and humans. And in the light of this assertion, it should be clear that the only professional officers which will have an expertise or have the expertise to act in the contemplated National Licensing Officer and other persons delegated by them officers to perform this function can be veterinarians. In conclusion, really, the submission which sought to tender comments to correct an aspect of the Performing Animal Protection Act Bill which relates to the professional involvement of veterinarians as adjudicating officers. We're mindful of the need of our profession to be centrally involved in adjudicating in advisory capacity as executive officers through the appointment of veterinarians to the Office of National Licensing Officer, and as experts delegated to perform her function. We are also aware that the 70-year-old Performing Animal Protection Act requires specialised legal expertise to strengthen its constitutionality and its legal structure. And to this end, we recommend that submissions from this court to be considered to ensure that the bill extends the purpose and protection which it's intended to provide for performing animals. In acting in animal welfare, veterinarians really have a balancing act to do, and that is we have to temper ideals of ideology with reality. And so we also take the interests of people who use performing animals as a source of income and for other purposes seriously. And I think part of the function of the Performing Animals Protection Act is also to assist these people to meet the standards and requirements laid down by the authority, and also to promote the welfare of animals in our society. Lastly, we reject the proposal that animal scientists, as contemplated and defined in the Amendment Bill, are suitably or uniformly qualified in knowledge and expertise to function alongside veterinarians as licensing officers. Whilst at the same time, we record our respect for the purpose and function of the Natural Sciences Professions Act and its council as a body to register professionals, candidates and certified natural scientists, and we acknowledge that among such scientists there may be persons who can play a positive and valued role in promoting animal welfare in South Africa, but their varied qualifications and background do not satisfy the requirements of a defined professional body other than veterinarians to be the decision makers, to be the source of professional adjudicating officers as contemplated in the Amendment Bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. J. Austin. We'll now go to individual, Mr. Henry Doyle.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Morning. Yeah, I'm a retired senior technician of the Department of Water Affairs. At one stage, I was taking the decisions of water rights, published schedules, and I was also delegated by the minister to work on the appeal board. I was also assisted state attorney in water court cases as a expert on the water rights and water. In 1997, we realized that this was our way was doing was not right, was not consistent with the Constitution, so the National Water Act was drafted. I've put something about the fire and the Constitution. Just one thing, in the magistrate under the 35 Act and 62 Act was done by the Department of Justice. So I think it was at that stage really natural for a magistrate to decide. But since then it's been separated. The licensing officer, I actually agree with him, but yesterday on my way here, I was driving along a road and I saw some water coming down the stormwater drain. So I stopped. there should be no water at that stage. And I stopped and I saw dirty polluted water coming down the channel. Then I drove further on. I didn't have the time. And the river was polluted there, green water. So further on the way from the site, I saw the SPGA, Now, it's possible if they wash their chain of kennels that the water is discharged into the stormwater drain. So it's polluted water. Okay, there's some B1, they've got some shacks there, and they also supply toilet facilities. So I don't really know. When I go back, I'll inspect it and see what's happening there. Or the water-filled air base might also discharge polluted water into the stormwater, and it's not acceptable.
Chairperson, I don't know if I'm a little bit lost in terms of the presentation that is being presented by Hendrik, Mr. Hendrik de Toit. Is it in line with the current hearings that we are having, or what is the situation? I seek your guidance, Chairperson.
It's in line. Why I'm saying that, because it's representing. Yes, like any other organization that should do the history and other things. So, let's be protected, Honorable.
Okay, thank you.
Honorable.
I'm not.
The tired professor.
Yeah, so the decision by the licensing officer and the licensing officer, I quite agree with that. Except I think he must also comply with other law like NEMA or Water National Act. He must know the act to know what to do. Okay, interested persons, okay, when we did the act, interested persons, I'll come back later on to, but affected persons can object to licenses, not interested persons. That's my opinion. I think the court should decide on that. If interest means the same as affected means the same as interested, but that's for the court to decide. But license conditions and stuff in the Water Act is supposed to be under regulations. Everything you do must be under regulations. So that the person that wants to train animals or wants to use animals know exactly before the time what it's up to. And not later on. Now, to build a facility takes money, and to get it ruled not correct later on will cause a lot of trouble. So the framing of regulations is brought in the Act, but it must be public participation. It must be subjected to the Parliament for approval, final approval. And it must be published, so everyone that wants to do something know what's happening there. Okay, now the appeal board. As I say, I was on the appeal board on the old Act, and that was allowed. But it must be independent. So the National Water Act actually took the Section 33, said it must be a court order, independent tribunal. So we took that to the independent tribunal, and the chairperson of that must be a lawyer or a law person, but it must be assisted by different type of persons, like veterinarians in this case, or people with knowledge. So it's a panel consisting of a legal, right, but assisted by these persons. So I only think that the appeal board in this case should be turned to a tribunal. You get the same results eventually. The definitions in the Act is not very clear for a person that always. I see even the regulations that was put out. They use the wrong words. They talk about safeguarding of animals. state of animals useful for safeguarding. So the definitions must comply and be readable to people. Again, the exempted things, I think, should be registered at least, but they must be subject to the same law or special law for their purpose. That's about all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hendrik. We'll now have the last presenter from United Front for Animals, Nikki Ile. Where's this? Here's the statement.
Sorry?
Here's the statement.
Can I not speak from this one? Will it not be clear enough?
I want you to face members of parliament.
Okay.
So you're breaking their necks. They can't. Not taking your minute.
Thank you very much, and firstly I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today, particularly at such very short notice, and unfortunately my submission was done in a great rush, so I'm hoping that I won't be rambling too much. I am the founder and director of United Front for Animals. Some of our founding principles include to protect all animals from abuse and exploitation, to do all that is necessary to alleviate suffering, raise awareness, campaign, and to educate and advocate on behalf of animals, domestic, farm, and wild animals. Pardon me. And firstly, before I continue with my submission, I'm grateful that I'm speaking after Dr. Lowe and speakers like Michelle, because the elephant riding industry is a bugbear of ours, and of course we agree and work very closely with Ban Animal Trading. I'm also the founder of the group No Animals in Circuses. So again, you're going to hear a submission primarily aimed at circus animals, because we feel so strongly about the fact that circus animals seem to fly under the radar, simply because there are so few of them in our country. Sorry, I really did this overnight, because I only heard yesterday that I should come and speak. So our input will be primarily directed at the issuing of licenses to circuses. And will essentially be a recommendation that animal services should not be issued licenses while it continues to operate as it does at present, i.e. traveling and performing all year round and the conditions under which the circus business operates. This recommendation is based on the fact that immense cruelty and suffering are inherent in traveling circuses, as no animals' needs can be provided for when confined to trailers and crates and in transit. We would like to provide a brief background against which we came to the conclusion that as far as circuses go, this is the only possible recommendation we can make. It is no secret that the Performing Animals Act is hopelessly outdated, as is the Animals Protection Act of 1962. The third act, the Societies for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, 1993, also falls short, as it focuses on cruelty rather than the welfare of animals. i.e. it falls short of international standards which include the welfare of animals in legislation. At the moment, our legislation in South Africa is primarily cruelty-based and not directed to the welfare of animals. When the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries took over the responsibility for these acts in 1997, a committee was formed in 2011 to develop an animal care policy and, I quote, to align the process with international norms and standards, guiding principles for animal welfare developed by the International Organization for Animal Health, the OIE. The committee was tasked to ensure the welfare of animals to the greatest extent possible and recognized that it is only once the needs of an animal are known that conditions and treatment methods can be developed and put into practice to fulfill the needs of animals and thus ensure their welfare. The committee accepted and endorsed as guiding principles, among others, the five basic freedoms, i.e. freedom from hunger, thirst and malnutrition, freedom from fear and distress, freedom from physical and thermal discomfort, freedom from pain, injury and disease, and freedom to express normal patterns of behavior. This, I must emphasize, was endorsed by the committee, which was established to look at the welfare of animals. And circus animals are regularly subjected to pain, often to injury, consistently to fear and distress, unremitting physical and thermal discomfort, and they never have the opportunity to express normal patterns of behavior. Also considering the duty the licensing officer has to determine whether the person applying for a license is fit and proper, we believe that this act cannot be amended without taking cognizance of this very important aspect of issuing licenses. There is currently no criteria for any licensing officer to take into account when he needs to decide what constitutes fit and proper, and we believe neither the nature of the use of animals nor what it entails can or should be regarded as being of no consequence when this is considered. We therefore contend that because of the cruelty and suffering inflicted on circus animals, no circus owner can be regarded as fit and proper because the very nature of their business means that traveling circuses present a series of recognized animal welfare problems, including no other working animals spend their entire year in temporary traveling accommodation. None. Excessive periods of time spent shut inside trailers, whether traveling or not, and in extreme and all weather conditions. Again, it does not apply to any other working animals. Temporary facilities lacking space and environmental enrichment for the entire working life. Limited exercise enclosures that are only available to some of the animals. For example, too many animals for the space provided, and they are sometimes on a parking area in a shopping center, no space for it. Use of the facility on a rotational basis cannot be maintained, and difficult animals are not allowed into the enclosure as a result, often. Traveling while sick, injured or pregnant and forced to give birth on the road or during a performance in a noisy environment. We had that with one of our animal circuses where a camel actually gave birth during a performance a few years ago. Violence or scaring of the animals and force being commonplace. Part of the circus culture and husbandry practices accepted as a means to move animals about. Some video footage of that is certainly available. Complex or unnatural tricks such as hind leg walking requiring very close control and domination during training, resulting in force and violence. Inappropriate groupings, which is very stress inducing, and positioning of cages, i.e. mixing of species or prey species close to predators
and herd species kept alone, or sometimes just two of them. Space will always be limited and facilities poor and inadequate and stress-inducing. Also, video footage available of that. Circus animals cannot be adequately monitored to ensure protection, which is the core function of the pawpaw. Conditions, stress and distress, including feeding and watering while traveling, are unknown. Training cannot and has not been monitored or determined. Wild animals' training starts when they are removed from their mothers soon after birth, when we believe the animal spirits are broken and its natural instincts suppressed by domination and violence. Circus owners invite members of the public to see rehearsals while training takes place, which they tell the members of the public is how they train, but in reality the training of these animals happen behind in a closed tent with a guard in front of it. So the actual training methods of circuses are unknown. In addition, stressed wild animals in close quarters with the public has proven to be a public health and safety hazard, with escaped animals both maiming and even killing members of the public, including children. Considering that it is incumbent on government to ensure the safety of communities, decision makers, which are the licensing officers, could surely be held responsible for injury and even death of members of the public and the well-documented circus animals who escaped over the years should be considered when licenses are issued, should they still be issued to circuses. In summary, we are of the opinion that circuses as performing animals as they operate currently cannot provide for the welfare of animals, and the inherent cruelty and suffering involved for animals in circuses, i.e. the nature of their business, dictates that owners of animal circuses cannot presently be regarded as fit and proper to hold the license under an act which core function is to protect animals. We further believe that only qualified wildlife experts can determine the well-being of animals, particularly of wild animals, of which I do not believe South Africa is enough readily available to fulfill the function of a licensing officer or inspector of performing animals, and of course that relates particularly to wild animals. In conclusion, our recommendations are that only a vet with a suitable, and that is, you know, we support, let me just qualify before I continue, we support entirely and 100% the ban called for by BAT. But if the committee decided animal circuses should still have licenses, this is our only recommendation, that only a vet with a suitable animal welfare and behavioral qualification should be recommended to issue licenses for all performing animals. A policy be developed and laid down to determine what constitutes a fit and proper person to hold a license for all performing animals in terms of that. Without that criteria, who decides who is fit and proper and on what basis? All transgressions in terms of prevailing legislation be documented and considered before a license is renewed. All incidents of escaped animals, of which one circus we have six, and hence the safety of the public, should be well documented and considered before a license is issued. A qualified professional similar to the licensing officer should be tasked with inspections. It's only a vet, and even when we say a vet can determine the health of the animal, as far as circus animals
in particular. Your time up, ma'am. Can you summarize?
Okay, I'm almost at the end of it. Okay. Can determine whether wild cats, for instance, cannot even be examined by a vet. Circuses only be issued with licenses if compulsory rest periods for animals are prescribed and the facilities at such rest camps farms are comparable to at least the minimum and acceptable zoo farm standards depending on the species. circuses only be issued licenses if they make the itinerary known to the licensing officer and it does not involve packing up and moving animals on a daily or even a weekly basis. Circuses only be issued with licenses if adequate exercise facilities, not just small holding pens and times, can be ensured, where they set up performances and that adequate protection is provided for such exercise facilities to obviate forced containment in trailers during adverse weather conditions. Circuses only be issued licenses once conditions on the road for at least 2 months during summer and 2 months during winter have been monitored and studied by 2 independent and suitably qualified professionals to establish the welfare of animals during traveling. Circuses only be issued licenses once training methods and the force, i.e. pain and distress necessary for training, have been properly studied and documented and compiled by animal welfare and behavioral experts. Readily available papers by experts regarding all facets of acceptable and unacceptable animal husbandry, including transportation and captivity.
Thank you very much. I must mention that we want to appreciate that even if you have not seen the advert, you notified the community that you want to come and present. We want to welcome that. I'm saying we welcome your presentation even after you have indicated that you've not seen the advert when we have publicized the bill. So we welcome your input. I'm now going to allow members to raise questions. Members, we have limited time. Let's not give speeches, let's ask questions so that your question can be answered, all of them, before the meeting is adjourned. I've got Honorable Carter, let me start with Honorable Jason because at that time I had him, and then Honorable Carter, Honorable Sultan, Honorable Stein, Honorable Ramapa, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. SA Dog Academy, Mr. Nicholas Mini. So you are saying now you don't train dogs, you train animals. But rather you don't train dogs, you train people. Yeah. Now I just want to get it clear. Do you train these people now in order to train these animals? Or perhaps you don't train dogs at all? So if that is the case, how do you expect these dogs to perform, to perform if they are not trained? I just want to get it clear from that. The last question now, the United Front for Animals. So we are saying now no animals at the circuses. At the same time, we are for this bill amendment. So where do you think now these animals should perform if perhaps now they are not allowed, as you suggest, at the circuses? Where are they supposed to perform? Because there are things that they should be at the circuses. So we just explain that. I want you to... That is correct, madam.
Okay. Sorry, ma'am. I'm the only one who's sharing this lesson.
You know
the question as members ask. I'm going to give you time to respond. Honorable Jason?
You're sick, madam. You say no animals at the circuses. They are just going to check now. Where do you expect these animals to perform if not at the circuses? In what form should they perform? Can you just explain that to me?
Just note the question. our stakeholders. Note them. We will come back to you. We will give you time to answer. Honorable Carter.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think firstly, it's just, I think it is very difficult not to make a statement as well, okay? But what I want to say is we're sitting with a situation where the pop-up ball, if we go back to the 1950s, was specifically aimed at circuses. But we cannot miss, right now as it stands, there's only 5 circuses, of which 3 has got animals. But it's the rest of the industry that has been affected and being influenced here. We're talking about the security dogs. We talk about any animals. Okay, we're talking here about, not about, about the circuses. We are talking here about what is going to happen at agricultural shows. Those are any animals. What is happening at the oceanariums? What is happening with the zoos? And these are where the concerns are. So the concerns right now is not 3 licenses, but possibly affecting 17,000 others who's got to get licenses and not the 3. Okay. Also, as a great animal lover and an elephant specifically, I traveled from the Shedrick Foundation in Kenya right to Nizna. With the veteran, so we can always have a cup of coffee afterwards. But one of the important things is that I really think that what we are reaching out here today is actually misguided, that a lot of this should actually be covered under the Department of Agriculture has got the wild animals in
we are still going to have time to discuss this, member. I want you to ask questions for clarification so that as you are going to discuss, you have that clarity of what the stakeholders are saying. So can we zoom into questions for clarity?
Chair, because we had about 5 presentations, I've got over 40, 50 questions listed here, but I'll just go to some of the points, okay? One of them is, for example, and I'm going to go specifically on the wild animal side. The recent cases of juvenile elephants, the recent cases of juvenile elephants, where was that actually, where did that take place in captivity? I know the Thule elephants goes back to 1999, but the recent cases, I think those are one of the important ones that we need clarity on. On the Dog Academy, I'm covered. No, actually, I'll leave mine for written presentation because all of it is questions about presentation on cruelty to animals and that type of thing, and it's not specifically to the palpable as a fact, to the point of the palpable. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. A little bit difficult to recall exactly who made what statements, but I'll try and be concise. The second presenter with a number of specific amendments to the F, I can't recall who that was, right? He spoke of 3H, as I just said, amendments to section 3H2C. My question there is, what problems do you anticipate with regard to the location of animals for use, because you have made some suggestions there. And my question to the presenter of C, I think it's ban animal trading. Is there any proof that the stress that these animals have had to put up with is beyond their capacity, perhaps beyond that of human beings? The reason I'm asking this question is because there seems to be an overemphasis of the fact that the animals are being ill-treated. Human beings, when they're striving to get something, also get, subjected to certain levels of stress. Now, why such a big issue? And lastly, or still on that one, is there any proof that this stress lasts beyond a certain period of time? Or is it stress whilst they are being trained? Or is it stress whilst they are operating, that is to say, performing? I will limit myself just for that, because all the presentation seem to be around the fact that animals are subjected to too much stress. So anyone can even supplement the answer that I will get. And that seems to be the main concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sultan. Honorable Sultan. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, my concern is also that
I think many of the presentations were made for something that's not currently in front of us. And it's not that that we do not respect what's here. I think you've made use of a opportunity, and I want to link it to the first presentation that we heard this morning. And it is questions that we will take back to the department, because to me this morning some of the presentations made sense, and I could see that we could add it so that we strengthen the bill. I would like to find out if the bill in its current form, with maybe a few amendments from presentations that we heard this morning, are in place, will you feel that it would strengthen the bill? Because we are looking at this stage really only at the licensing part of it, and how the licensing will happen, and how appeals will happen. And also, I think a very important part is at least to have a register of who received licenses and what the licenses was received for. Would you think that that would strengthen the board in its current form? Or not? I'm asking all the presenters, because many of the issues that you brought forward is a longer other process. And it is something that we must deal with. But would you be happy if we could look at least strengthening the licensing part, giving people more access to who is licensed, where was it licensed for? And then in taking a later process in maybe bringing the bowl back or scrapping the bowl in totality and making sure that we look at the animal welfare part of it, because it's not really what we are looking at the moment. And we told the department we are not happy that they didn't look at the change of the total bowl, but at this stage we are almost bound by the constitutional court case that we need to finish this in a certain period. But would you be happy for a short period if we can just look at the strengthening of the licensing? I'm asking the questions to all the presenters.
No, Honourable Spain just covered me, because I was going to the issue of the subject for now. At this meeting, I think the subject was precisely specific for a particular objective. I think the rest of the other discussions, yes, as she just put it, quite uncovered.
Honorable Pule Mavi and Honorable Yongi.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is around, I can't really recall which organization or institution they were representing, but they spoke about having this animal welfare officers. Is it a view of stakeholders that such a move should also be incorporated into the prescripts of the legislation, where legislation makes it a standard, so that one of the things that you should have to try, because the issue of welfare kept on coming out more and more from a lot of stakeholders. So from an oversight point of view, we also need to be advised that is that a feeling that legislation should also advance such a view, that you should have welfare officers. But again, also on the question of adjudication, I was not quite clear whether stakeholders are contesting having the magistrate playing the licensing role, or they are effectively saying that we should also try and bring some expert opinion as it relates to the issuance of licenses, especially for performing animals. And I thought that as I was trying to go through the legislation, and I realized that it still enforces the licensing authority to be the magistrate. So maybe we could be clarified on those things as well. It's a very complicated subject, Chair. So we are taking it as we move.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just a small question to Mr. Mini. He never got to that point in his presentation, but I see in the written version of it that he refers to a papa license being 30 rand and taking 9 months, and then there's talk of 54 million rand. Maybe he can just clarify that for me, please. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm now going to allow our stakeholders to respond. But as you're going to respond, I just wanted to, as other members have raised it, that we are dealing with the amendment of the bill, the existing bill. But we just want to indicate that, and we're focusing only on relieving judiciary services to awarding license to relevant administrators, which is Department of Agriculture in this context. Secondly, just to highlight to our stakeholders that the department has reported to this committee that they are working on a welfare bill, animal welfare bill, which some of the presentation that was made were directing to the welfare part of the animals. For now, we are looking at regulating what court has asked us to regulate in terms of the issuing of licenses. And as one member has asked, that our most interesting element that we want to find out is in the, as we take the function, what is the recommendation of members of our stakeholders in terms of strengthening and tightening the licensing process such that it's not subject to abuse. And as one member said, I think the CPA was saying that people would have the opportunity to, if they go to this magistrate, they don't get the good results, they'll jump to another one. So I think those are the things that we were looking at. But we have actually welcomed your presentation, because I think even department is here, as they are going to build on the bills, already they have the views of the stakeholders. I'm now going to allow you to respond. Those that the question has been directed to. Yes, ma'am?
I'm not responding in order because I can't remember who asked what first. But in terms of the photographs, some of them I took myself from Elephants Forever in Limpopo. The others come from the Elephant Park and the Elephants in Eden. So, and those ones are fairly recent. The problem with all of this is that there's no oversight, there's no monitoring. And this is what this legislation hopefully will accomplish, in that we will be able to have access to these places and they won't be closed to accountability or transparency. And if this legislation becomes in pieces, and we first have to be happy with the licensing oversight and then an overhaul of the actual legislation, I would please ask members of this committee to ensure that access to information around the licensing is key, a key component, because as NGOs who are trying to monitor what's going on in these industries, it's almost impossible. And access to information is crucial. One of the issues around the licensing officer, I personally believe that having a vet is just a vet is completely wrong. Vets are part of this industry, and I know if I'm talking specifically around elephants, vets have been responsible for some of the cruelty involved. So I think you can't just say that deaths are closer to deaths and everything will be all right. They don't actually have a proper code of ethics that speaks to animal welfare. If you look at their rules and procedures, it's not there. So therefore, I think it's really important to have animal welfare, animal rights people, but also experts, like in the case of elephants. There are people who are behavioral experts, specifically in relation to elephants, and they should be brought in when people are applying for licenses. And finally, I think that if this is going to be a process, people that are already in the industry and you've seen there's a lot of abuse, how is this going to deal with current abuse? I mean, just by making, you know, a licensed officer, changing it from a magistrate to somebody else, actually doesn't help the animals in the industry. And if members could think around this in terms of not leaving these animals to the mercy of an unmonitored, unfettered industry, in ways that are creative, that would be great. In terms of the stress issue, there's a lot of research by psychologists around PTSD, which is suffered by humans, people that are tortured and so on, and it's in exactly the same environment. So I guess it's within a more moral framework in terms of how much stress do you apply to somebody before you actually break them. And these elephants that I'm talking about are specifically, they are broken. They are broken and they need a lot of rehabilitation. And our foundation is about trying to rescue these elephants and provide places for them, places of safety where they can live a more natural life.
There was a question about training of handlers and training of dogs. My remark was unfortunately taken literally. Let me explain. In the police force, if you go for dog training or dog evaluation, you get a dog and you would take it through the whole process, right, for 3 months. In the industry for dogs for safeguarding, we've got dogs that are used for, if I say puppies, that's their mental attitude, they're playful. That would be dog number one. We're talking about a handler, one handler. Then he puts dog number one through its paces, certain paces. Then he goes to dog number two, who is more progressed. So every time the dog is of a standard that is higher than what he's just had previously. Now this is done in a day. The third dog would be very much more. This is to control dogs over various obstacles. So by the end, the handler would be handling or training a dog. But de facto, the dogs are already trained to a standard. So that is how I would explain that. Is that okay? Some of the handlers would have 6 to 8 dogs that they would handle in a training session. Not all training establishments do the same. I'm talking about our training establishment. The accreditation profile, while we were doing the various stakeholders meeting, a member of the DAF board came to me, one of the ladies, and she was interested in the way we accredited training establishments and handlers at CIRA. And I went through, there's a general profile, a profile for general details, and that is filled in, and it is audited by a responsible person from CIRA who is trained to do this. Now, when it comes to the instructors at CIRA, they go up to grade 5. Grade 5 would be your substance detection work. So the easy part is 1, 2, 3, and 4. That is the protection work. But grade 5 would be the substance detection. And to get back to the accreditation, the state vet would be, we suggest, must be the final authority in the licensing. The profile is... Then another profile is done this is all in the application form, which is specific. In our case, it is specific for protection work. And then we'll have another one which is restriction of substances, various substances. The substances would be anything from an arson dog, a gold dog, medical, anything of that nature, all which is specific. The other, I don't know if that, oh yes, then those two profiles will be submitted to the state then. That is, this is all in our stakeholders meeting, and he would obtain the license. It should be a formality. The same formality is if you go as an individual to SARS and you ask for a clearance certificate. All the details are there, and they give a clearance certificate. It's the same as if you go for a licensing of of your driver's license or your motor car. It should be, a clerk should be in a position, if they follow procedures, it should be issued. Then the only problem comes in when it's declined. Now, it can only be declined on specific matters, not on trivial things. And this is what we in the industry have had, and that is why, unfortunately, the SPCA have developed a very bad reputation from the stakeholders. I'll give you an example. I have to give you this example. Our license was subject to the following. No dogs are allowed to be confined in kennels for longer than 12 hours. Why? It doesn't state it anyway. No dogs are allowed to work for longer than 12 hours. That means if the poor guy has to, the handler works for 13 hours because he has to do overtime, then there's going to be a criminal charge. No dogs to live on site and must be returned to the kennel base daily. There's nothing in the law that prohibits that. Bearing in mind that some of our dogs work at celebrities, political celebrities. No dogs are allowed to work 7 days per week. Now, we spoke about stress. If you want to see a security dog stress, is when he doesn't go to work. Dogs are not humans. If they don't go to work, those dogs they stress up. And that is the reason why we don't like using Dobermans, because they are highly active dogs. And it's a big problem for us. No dogs are allowed to work 7 days. And no dog must work more than 5 days in a row with a minimum of 1 day off spent in an exercise area before starting to work again. All dogs must be provided with chew toys. Chew toys. That means that the person who wrote this letter has got no idea what toys are. Now, I did mention right at the beginning of my speech or my presentation that toys are also used, but it's used as a training assistant. You train a dog, he does it correctly, and you play with a toy, and the dog goes crazy, and they love it. But you don't leave it with him. If he's accomplished an exercise, you give him his chew toy, or we don't call it a chew, we call it just a toy. He plays with his toy, and you take it away immediately. All dogs must be provided with chew. Okay. All dogs, cow hooves. I tell you, if you go to a good vet, he'll do his nut if you talk about cow hooves, because they have more problems with cow hooves than anything else. That was left in the kennel. So you must give him a cow hoof, and you leave him in the kennel. All dogs must be microchipped. Now, the people that first started microchipping in South Africa is us. We started microchipping, and we insisted on microchipping of the Sierra dogs, or tattooing of ears. That's another thing that can cause pain. But that is the old method of doing it. The breeders from Germany, overseas, they do it. But we insist on microchipping. All dogs must be removed from their kennels during cleaning. The only people that does that is the military.
You are repeating the presentation, sir.
No, I'm not repeating it. I'm making a point here, Madam Chair.
No, I understand, but can you summarize?
Yeah. Now, this is what was given to the magistrate to decide on. And there's no law that forbids us from doing that. And that is what has caused tremendous amount of ill feeling with the magistrate doing it and a welfare organization insisting on these things. So that covers that one. I've got your welfare involvement is okay, but not specific. We don't mind welfare involvement, but not SPCA. Unfortunately, the Animal Protection Act says, in small letters, a society for the prevention of cruelty to animals. That doesn't say it is the SPCA, because it's the Animal Anti-Cruelty League, and there are others that you can talk to. You don't have this jackboot attitude that they have, the SPCA have. The lady asked me about the Papa license, the 30 Rand. Yeah, I have to put on another hat from LATA, the Licensed Animal Training Association. They mentioned it to me. I must ask, why go through such an expensive system as proposed? And that is the reason why we came up with this proposal, where even your local vet, your local vet, when it comes to movement of animals from here to, say, from Johannesburg to Durban, and there's a rabies outbreak, your local vet gives you a permit. There's nothing wrong with that. You take that to the state vet, and it's countersigned. To get to the costs, that is where the costs came in. It comes from LATA. I've dealt with NSPC applicants going to other magistrates. That's impossible. You can only go to the magistrate of your magisterial district. So if the magistrate of another district issues you with a license and you stay in Cape Town but he's in Johannesburg, then the magistrate's not doing his job correctly. And if I would say it's illegal. Dogs under stress, we've covered that.
Thank you very much. Yes? Sir?
I'm Dr. Wilson from the Veterinary Association, and I just wanted to respond to...
Time. I don't want to cut stakeholders, because you are more important to this, the functioning of Parliament. Please assist us so that we are able to be in time again for other work that we need to do.
Thank you. I just want to respond to Michelle Picover's comments that veterinarians can sometimes be part of the problem. That might well be the case, but certainly in the situation of the Performing Animal Protection Act, the National Licensing Officer and people delegated with powers to administer the Act must be independent. And clearly they're not being paid by clients or anything like that. The other thing is, if veterinarians are part of any problem in animal welfare, it's contrary to the values of the profession, and it ought to be formally reported. And I'm not aware of any complaints being lodged with our South African Veterinary Council about these particular issues. And until such complaints are lodged, it's difficult to respond specifically to the comment, but it might well be the case. And I would encourage then organizations like EMS to bring it to the attention of the regulating authority, the Veterinary Council. Thank you.
Thank you. I just have two questions that I need to answer. The first one was somebody asked, as you said, about the proof of, you know, from research and so on, that animals are traumatized. I think we only need to look at domestic animals, for example, animals, you know, dogs that are kept confined in a small kennel and are trained with means of negative training and scaring them into submission and so on. Once those dogs are rescued, they have been traumatized, and it takes time to actually rehabilitate them and so on. And so much more with wild animals, who do something that is completely against their nature, sitting on bar stools, jumping through hoops, doesn't work. And then, as I said in the beginning, we are against the use of animals in the circus, but if the permit process goes through, we would like for it to be an open process, number one. We would like to see what the terms and conditions are for all these licenses that are going to be given out. And also we, I suppose we can't say that we insist, we ask that on all these committees, somebody from an animal rights organization is present to represent the interests of the animals.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also going to just confine my comments to questions. The first question that was asked was the Section 3H2C, what problems are anticipated at the locations or sites. The problems we have is that animals are trained and or stationed at different locations, not necessarily at the same facility where they apply for their licenses, and those sites need to be checked whether they can accommodate, one, the type of animal that's there. You can't take an elephant into Middle Joburg to train it there. That's the first issue. The second issue is how those animals will live in those environments, or whether they will live there or be moved around. So that is why we've asked for that amendment. Then the next question was whether we'll be happy with the bill should the comments be taken into consideration. We would. That is why we confine our comments to the actual bill, and we've made specific submissions to those sections that we've referred to. And as far as pulling experts into the adjudication process, definitely we do need experts, especially when it comes to wild animals. We do need experts in those fields to advise the licensing officer or committee, whichever is set up, in respect of the type of conditions that need to be applied. I'm not sure if I may respond to comments made by another organization.
Okay, thank you very much for the input. Ma'am, you want to? Okay.
Thank you. I'll just add and try to be as brief as possible. I was asked where circuses are, or circus animals are supposed to perform. We believe that they shouldn't perform at all. Animals, wild animals, in fact, no animals should be made to do tricks. And we should go with the global movement, you know, where more than 40 countries and states have already banned the practice. It's a medieval, okay practice. Proof of stress and suffering, stereotypical behavior, elephants swaying, tigers and lions pacing up and down. It is well documented. Many papers have been written about it. There is no question about that they just do not cope, and even if they out of that unseenable captivity and put into a big area, it takes ages for them not to pace just that little section because they are mentally totally damaged. Would the licensing procedure strengthen the act? It will help a little bit, but it really is a drop in the bucket. I don't think the act, I believe, should be overhauled altogether, but if there is a procedure where a properly qualified person is appointed as a licensing officer, and I do believe it should be a vet, but not only just a vet, somebody who is qualified in welfare and holds a recognized qualification in welfare and behavioral of animals, and that includes wild animals. And that we should be able, all organizations should be able to make submissions to the licensing officer if we feel that a license should not be issued, and that those submissions should be taken into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've realized, listening to this debate, I've realized there is a lot of discussion that we need to have as South Africans, because it's about, you're speaking on behalf of animals who cannot speak for themselves, and you have, and from which angle are we coming from? Where is our baseline? Because And until we get converted ourselves as a South African, then you can speak out, speak for something that cannot speak for itself. So I'm saying that there is a lot of, and I start to understand why it took time for departments to develop the welfare bill. So the discussion itself is telling me that it's a very difficult. It's like, you know, I was laughing when they said some of the vets are part of the problem. And I said, how these people, they went to school to train on animals, to understand the animals for 7 years, some. So it means that they need another workshop for welfare, because these others, and I was saying, in my mind, I've never had any colleges that deals with welfare of animals with the certificate. So, you know, and as you are governing, it's become very, very difficult for you to to understand or to come to a particular conclusion. But we want to appreciate and welcome this presentation. It has opened our eyes as members of this parliament, and indeed we'll work with the department to make sure that as we amend this bill, we're looking at how best can we tighten in the issue of the welfare part. And thank you very much, our stakeholders. Go well. The meeting is not adjourned for only visitors. You are released. So members of the committee can stay behind. Our stakeholders, there is a snack at the back. That gratis will request that you eat outside so that we don't stop the meeting, so that we are able to finish in time ourselves. Thank you very much again. Members, let's grab something to eat for 5 minutes and come back.